Inspired by the tireless work of a social reformer, the Albion Fellows Bacon Center is celebrating 40 years of service to the Evansville area. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, we learn more about the namesake of the center, also the many services available to the victims and survivors of domestic abuse and sexual violence. And we'll hear from one of the survivors who calls the Albion Center her lighthouse and her lifesaver. So when does a victim become a survivor? How these cases impact children and families, and what you can do to help someone out of a dangerous situation. It's all ahead on 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, you may have heard this name before, Albion Fellows Bacon, the namesake of the Evansville Shelter for Domestic and Sexual Violence Victims. After her death in 1933, she was called the city's best-known and most-loved woman. Now, we're going to learn more about her legacy and the shelter and programs that bear her name. The Albion Fellows Bacon Center is celebrating its 40th anniversary, not only serving the local community, but families in 11 southwestern Indiana counties. The shelter's story goes back to the 1970s and a group called the Evansville Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Over the years, the center grew from a small house purchased for, I think, about $33,000 to larger buildings, paid staff, and crisis services, including prevention, outreach, education, and much more. And here to start us off is Julia Catheri, interim executive director of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center. And later we'll hear from a local survivor who sought and received help from Albion. Julia, welcome to 2 Main Street. And now before we celebrate this 40th anniversary and hear about the future of Albion, let's go back in time, introduce us to Albion Fellows Bacon, quite a lady.
Oh my goodness, Albion Fellows Bacon is a trailblazer. As an Evansville native, we should just be so excited and honored to speak of her 100 years almost after her death, even. Before she even had the right to vote, Albion Fellows Bacon was really a volunteer, unpaid lobbyist. She, for 3 full years, would travel to the state legislature and sit in session. She never missed a day for 3 full sessions. This was before she could even vote as a woman. And she was, as an unpaid lobbyist, volunteer lobbyist, fighting for legislation here in Indiana to improve the housing conditions of the common person. So Albion herself was from moderate well-off means. She married young, but in her early 20s, she married a mercantile here in Evansville. And so she had 4 children. She was, you know, considered middle to upper class, if you will, here in Evansville back in the early 1900s. But she was very engaged in the community and very moved by that not all humans had the same safe, sanitary living conditions. And housing back in the day, in the early 1900s, there was no real legislation on the books back then across the United States. And so Albion was a real trailblazer. She was fighting for better housing conditions. And so for 3 full years, she was at the General Assembly, you know, talking with the legislators, which were basically all older white men.
But they couldn't ignore her.
They could not ignore her. She was there every day. And she, of course, was also a published author. So she was very, very well spoken. And she just continued to make her case until some housing legislation was passed. And that was even before women had the right to vote in 1919.
She was born in 1865, mm-hmm. died in 1933, described as a municipal housekeeper, yeah. cleaning up slums and improving living conditions. Of course, the Albion Fellows Bacon Center celebrating its 40th anniversary. It's a safe haven for survivors of abuse. Yeah.
Well, you know, much like Albion Fellows Bacon herself was fighting for the living conditions of those less fortunate, that's really what we want to proliferate and to be her legacy here in Evansville as the Albion Fellows Bacon Center. We focus on working with survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, stalking, and our safety measures include everything from a crisis line, 24-hour crisis line that's operated every day of the year around the clock, to crisis response out in the community where we will send an advocate to a safe and neutral location. It might be the hospital, it could be the jail even, the police department, the sheriff's department. We want to meet survivors where they're at, as close to the crisis as possible. And so we'll send out our team of advocates to meet a survivor in a safe location. We also have the emergency shelter where if someone doesn't have a safe place to flee or escape, then we will shelter them for a period of time. And then we're working with that family, not only the parent, the adult head of household, but also the children to really help them with trauma-informed care services to help them heal and begin their journey to recovery.
Now let's bring Sarah Nurnberger in here now. She's one of the survivors. Sarah, the safety aspect of it, that had to be very important to know that you were safe and secure at Albion.
Yes. When I got linked up with them, it's just a way of feeling like you have that aided support and safety measure. I had my abuser in jail during the initial time period that I was involved with Albion, but we didn't know how the trial would pan out over the course of that year. So there was always that thought in the back of my head if he got out and the safety components that these ladies at Albion just made you feel at home and safe.
We are very public. We want to be friendly to the public, certainly, but we also want to be mindful that families who are in acute crisis are actually living in our facility, and it's their home, and much like none of us would want someone necessarily to drop by unannounced, particularly someone we may not know very well, and particularly if we're in a situation where we may be being stalked or followed or in danger, and so that's all. We just ask the public to be mindful of that. So if they stop by unannounced, they may be asked to make an appointment and come back. But we do want to be welcoming. We wouldn't be here 40 years later without the support of the community. And so we're not necessarily hiding. There's no stigma that goes along with someone who is needing our services at all. Domestic and sexual violence can certainly happen to any of us, and it does happen to any of us. So we're not trying to imply that survivors ought to have to hide or be tucked away from the community's view or anything like that. We're just being mindful that our location is a residential facility and families live there.
We're going to hear Sarah's story here in a little bit, but let's go back to the facility itself. Now, we talked about that first small building, and then it expanded now. The current facility, can you kind of give us a tour? How many rooms, beds, staff, children's playground?
Absolutely. Well, we recently expanded also with the help of the community. So we've added some office space. Now all of our entire team is in one location. We were kind of scattered here and around because we'd run out of room. We still do have an advocate located at Holly's House, and we have an advocate up in Gibson County. But the rest of our team is located in one location now, and we've added three family rooms. So we now have 12. We can house 12 families at a time. On occasion, we may ask families to double up, but, you know, and it's been 18 months now since the pandemic, so we've kept families in their own rooms. And that has limited the number of people we can serve on any given night. But we're making do. We're also putting people in the community out in stable housing as quick as possible. We're building out our services. But we went from 9 bedrooms, for our first 38 years to, 39. Almost 40 years, and now we're just now opening up 3 more family rooms in our facility.
Now, you mentioned Holly's House. There's mm-hmm. also the Lampion Center and the YWCA. Now, do all these agencies work together?
We do. It's so important for survivors to have a collaborative community working together, because survivors, you know, really, and I always say this, a place to go to get immediate safety, like an emergency shelter, or to have a crisis advocate available, you know, to respond when someone is in immediate crisis is really important. But those types of services, the legal advocacy, the support group, those kinds kinds of things, the children's services that we provide, they're necessary, but they're not sufficient in a journey, the full journey of a survivor. So it's really important for programs and organizations to work together and collaborate so that a whole continuum can be built to strengthen a community and to give a warm handoff to that survivor when that person has journeyed through acute crisis intervention services and is ready to, for the next step. And so it's so important, our partnerships that we have with Lampion and Holly's House and the YWCA, because it really takes all of us to lock arms and to wrap around the survivor and their family during this time.
Now, Sarah, I'm curious, how long did you stay at the shelter there at Albion?
So I was fortunate enough that I had a support system that I was able to stay with people for my own safety. So I didn't have to stay at the emergency shelter, but I was very linked up with the group therapy and the legal advocacy portion of their services.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long does a person usually stay at the emergency shelter? Is there a...
We typically have a 45 to 90 day stay, but we've been really creative, you know, because the truth of the matter is it's like survivors are going to exit somewhere from this emergency situation. They're going to leave and go back home oftentimes. They're going to leave and maybe stay with a family member or relocate. Or the ideal situation would be that they would exit to a permanent and safe housing solution of their own, an apartment, a home. But we all know that in every community across the country right now, being able to afford housing is a serious issue. There's just not enough housing that people can afford, particularly on one income. And so when you're in an acute crisis where you've left a relationship, where you've left potentially another income in your family, and you're trying to start over, you're trying to get back on your feet, it can take somebody a long time to do that, particularly if you have children. We all, you know, we've been hearing this community conversation about living wage and what is a living wage? What does it take for one adult, you know, to be able to survive and to afford rent or to afford a mortgage payment? You can imagine it takes 2 to 3 times that for a parent with one or more children. And so what we're looking at is a 45-day, even a 90-day stay in an emergency shelter is inadequate for most survivors, particularly those who are coming in with really strapped resources and who have not been allowed to work. So we're looking at actually shifting our model to either go for longer-term housing stays there at Albion, but really focusing our services on helping people exit successfully to safe, sustainable housing of their choosing.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Julie Catheri. She's the interim executive director of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center, celebrating its 40th anniversary. And we have a survivor here with us, Sarah Nernberger, who's going to share her story a little later in the next segment. Now, before we move on, let's learn more about Julia Catheri, the interim director. You've been making the trip back and forth from Indianapolis to Evansville. Tell me about that.
I have been the last couple of months, and I will be for the next several months serving as the interim executive director at Albion. But it's been an honor and a pleasure. I may not feel that way in January and February when we're getting some really icy weather, but I'll accommodate for that. I started my career in the domestic and sexual violence intervention, response, and prevention field at Albion Fellows Bacon Center back in 1994. So this is an honor to be able to come back. I've lived in Indianapolis since early 2004. I was at Albion for about 10 years and really worked in a multitude of their direct services. I did outreach, non-residential services, going into high schools and doing dating violence presentations, to facilitating support group, to eventually running the shelter program and directing the residential services. And so it's an honor to do this. This is where I feel my roots in this field. I feel Albion Fellows Bacon's her legacy every day. And so when the board approached me to see if this is something that I would entertain, and I have executive director leadership on my resume, and in my past I was the CEO at Coburn Place Safe Haven in Indianapolis for 11 years and left there in the spring. And so when the board at Albion approached me, it touched my heart, and I couldn't say no. So a few hours on the road here and there every week is worth it.
So are you a native of Evansville then?
I am, Southern Indiana. I was born in Evansville, grew up in Mount Vernon in Post Posey County, just up the way or down the way, along the Ohio River. And so, yeah, Evansville and this area is my home. We're transplants to Indianapolis, but we always call Evansville our home.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk more about the Albion services. We're going to meet and hear more from Sarah's story about being a survivor and the support she received from Albion. We're also going to find out if COVID-19 has affected the number of local cases of domestic and sexual violence, and what should you do if you suspect someone is being abused. That's very important. And this message from Albion: it's never the victim's fault. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are here to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Evansville-based Albion Fellows Bacon Center, which provides services to domestic and sexual assault and abuse victims, not only in the Evansville area, but also 11 southwestern Indiana counties. Julia Catheri is the interim executive director of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center, named after a social reformer who dedicated her life to improving working and living conditions for women in Indiana. Joining Julia is a survivor who sought and received help from the Albion Center, Sarah Nurnberger. So let's start with you, Sarah. Was Albion a lifesaver?
Yes, very much so. You know, in some of the speeches I've gave, I've actually referred to them as the like my lighthouse. So that's interesting that you said the lifesaver analogy there. I kind of, you know, while it seems corny, their ray of light from like a lighthouse, it's like they're standing there with that light, but you have to kind of just want to reach out and grab it. And their light saved me, honestly. They really did.
Well, obviously you've talked publicly about your problems, and can you kind of give us a summary of what happened in your life?
In 2018, I was in an intimate relationship with my abuser for about a year until early 2019 when I got linked up with Albion. And of course, the relationship doesn't always start out terrible. You'll hear that at Albion as well. They kind of honeymoon you in at the beginning. I didn't see a lot of the signs of it at first. Then several months in, it would start off with small things like shoving and jealousy. And then as the year transpired, it became more aggressive in nature. And that all led up to the events that pretty much transpired in January of 2019 that sent him to jail.
So were you physically abused?
Yes. Throughout the year, it started off with the shoving and the pushing that he would kind of downplay as not abuse, and then slapping and those sorts of things got involved. But in January of 2019, I was assaulted, beaten, strangled, and confined.
Did you receive hospital treatment?
I did not. Following the incident, when I was able to escape and leave, I went immediately to my sister's. I had been kind of in denial for a few months over it, and I was getting to that point in my recovery of realizing that, wow, I really am in a domestic violence situation. I remember pulling away to go to my sister's, and I looked in my rearview mirror and saw my big black eye. That was one of the most severe times that I had been assaulted by him, and it kind of sunk in. I was still processing it for a long time, but it sunk in that I've got to do something. This is different. So I went to my sister's for a while. He was making threats to my family that he was going to go hurt them. So it was a thing where hospital, although that sounds terrible, treatment to put on the back burner. Those first several hours were crucial as to me figuring out safety, where I can go to be safe, with who, how do I report this so that he won't come after my family and my loved ones. It was the safety component for me, so I didn't go to a hospital, no.
Did he express any remorse for his actions?
No. Honestly, still to this day, he has never shown remorse in court. He led on to believe that he was remorseful, but I've known him off and on since college, and many of these abusers are narcissists, you know, and they're very manipulative, And he was very manipulative in the relationship throughout the court trial. And he appeared to be remorseful, but I don't know how to say this for lack of, not very sympathetic to him, obviously, but it seemed very put on. He was acknowledging that he hit me, but there were certain charges that he felt that he didn't do. They actually offered him a plea deal at one time that he was going to be given the bare minimum. And actually, if that had happened, he would be out on the streets right now. So the way it transpired was just meant to be, honestly. But the female judge that I had, I felt like she was backing the story, the situation, while she was taking everything into consideration. At his plea deal hearing, she actually didn't find a factual basis for what he was saying and trying to agree to what he thought happened. And she said, no, this is going to trial.
Well, I'm curious, when you decided to press charges, what was that process like? Do you feel like you were treated fairly by law enforcement and the prosecutor's office?
Absolutely. You know, people have mixed feelings sometimes about those things and the reporting process. But for me, I had a very positive experience with both with Albion, with EPD, with the prosecutor's office who worked with me very closely as well as Albion. It was all an experience for me that, as I told Julia last week, really that whole journey is how I transitioned from victim to survivor. The officer that came to get the report from me when I turned him in, honestly, there was many things that saved my life, but that was the first lifeline, the first lifesaver that you referred to, that kind of got thrown to me, that clicked in my head, like, I'm going to do this. This needs to make it, there's something needs to be done. It's not okay.
Now, Julia, this, I mean, every story you hear probably is heartbreaking, and I'm sure hers is typical. Can you share any more stories that you can let our audience know about the people that you serve?
Yeah, you know, I think when I heard Sarah's story the first time last week, she'd been working with Albion for many years, but she and I, learned of each other and met last week, and I want to thank her for coming with me today. You're right, there's so many stories like Sarah's, but they're each individual and unique, and yet have this very common thread that runs through them, in that harm doers or abusers are manipulators. They can be very charming, very charismatic as a weapon against the person they're doing harm. And when you think about power and control, people use all kinds of tactics, but the purpose is to get power and to keep control. So they may use things like emotional manipulation and jealousy, name calling that could escalate into physical abuse, such as what Sarah suffered, financial abuse, sexual abuse. And then once the survivor leaves, it may turn into stalking type behavior to get that person to come back or to keep them under their power and control. But over the almost 30 years that I've done this work, there's been thousands of survivors, innumerable really at this point, that I have worked with. I used to do the crisis response here in Evansville, where I would go to hospitals, go to the police station and meet with a survivor, a victim at that point. Sarah, that's a really good point at that time. Mm-hmm. They may not feel like a survivor yet. Sarah has a wonderful point about how she can recognize the moment that she stepped from being a victim into her survivor journey.
Let's talk about that, that moment when you realize that, okay, I've got to take control of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, kind of as she said, it really is a process. It's not an overnight thing by any means. At the beginning of it, even turning him in, I was still very much a little bit in denial as to, I'm a victim of domestic violence. You know, growing up with, I've had a fairly decent normal upbringing where you don't think growing up, I'm going to be in a situation like this. I never saw myself in a situation as this. And as Julia said, it can and does happen to everyone. It doesn't discriminate. So laying there on the floor that day after he had assaulted me, it kind of sunk in, wow, I'm a victim of domestic violence. Like that day it sunk in. And within weeks of that, I was still processing that. Through the group therapy there, I was still processing, I'm a victim of this. But throughout the process, and I don't, now that I feel myself as a survivor, I kind of, when I think of the term victim, like she said, we almost like to use the term survivor, but there is a process of it, and you get to that point through various things. For me, it was that whole legal journey of that year and having the support of Albion along the way, going through to group therapy consistently, going to the legal proceedings with my advocates from Albion, and then when I took the stand, while that was one of the most terrifying moments of my life, that and the victim impact statement that I gave at his sentencing, those were the days that I felt like I'm a survivor, I'm not a victim anymore.
I know you're getting very emotional.
Yes,
here.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
It was a little bit of both. So a little bit about me, kind of with the background of the story. The trial got reset 3 times. There was multiple hearings that he was fighting things on, and I showed up at every hearing. Even the small little things, I showed up at every hearing. And that was part of my journey in my healing process of being present and taking a stand and making a point that I'm not backing down and it's not okay. So it was terrifying. I had never taken a stand. You know, that's not a normal common thing that most people do. I actually did reach out to Holly Dunn for advice. When you take the stand, what's something you can do before you take the stand to kind of help you?
Now, Holly Dunn, of course, the survivor of the railway killer who was executed for all of his crimes, Holly Dunn Pendleton. And she speaks all around the country.
She's
about
the founder
this.
Of Holly's House.
She is that's right. She's the namesake of Holly's House.
Yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead. When you're talking about, you talk to Holly.
Yes. So just resources in the community, because honestly, my family was a good support system for me, but what Albion did for me is my family did not know and experience domestic violence. So while they could talk to me and try to help me, they didn't really know or understand what I was going through. Those people in my group therapy from all walks of life, like she was bringing up earlier, we all had different backgrounds, but we all had experienced, when you experience that kind of trauma, you have similar responses. We're all different in how we manage it, but we felt the same. We all could relate to that. So what the Albion Advocates did for me was they made me feel comfortable and safe. They almost felt like my sisters, you know, I have sisters, but they made me feel like sisters that understood what I was going through and they believed me.
Now, the importance, I guess, of fellow survivors gathering together, telling their stories, that has to be very empowering.
It is so empowering. I think that, you know, to Sarah's point, victimization is something that can happen to any of us. But it's not our identity. And when we move into survivorship as a part of who we are, we're stepping into a place of taking control back in our lives, taking our self-efficacy back, our mastery, our self-agency, and the control back in our life. And I think that that's why it's so notable to many people who've had something just terrible happen to them over a period of time, even some longer than others. But when they begin to move into that place, and that's what places like Albion Fellows Bacon Center is focused on, is giving people the space, the grace to move back into having control over their own life and making their own choices and having the self-agency and the support, those standing behind your back, cheering you on, and you don't have to do it perfectly. You know, moving back into self-empowerment and taking ownership back over your life and taking the control back, it can be messy for many people, you know, and everybody needs something a bit different. And that's why we want to have a multitude of services and programs and personalities. And none of our advocates are the same, but they all have this passion for the work and they all have this commitment and dedication to the work. And I think it's just so important to meet people where they are. And that's what survivor-centeredness is all about, is really remembering that Sarah and other women and men are people. And this is something that's happened to them, but they are survivors. They are humans like any of us who are just journeying back into taking control of their lives.
Now, Sarah, you told me earlier that you really weren't a public speaker before this, and now you have a message to pass along to people.
Yes. You know, growing up, I was the one in college who would always dodge the public speaking classes. It was not my thing. And it's interesting that through this journey now, I've kind of taught myself that it's okay to be vulnerable and reach out and public speak, because part of my healing process and what I want to do for other victims and survivors is realize it's okay, and you shouldn't be ashamed to tell your story. There's so many people out there that have gone through all walks of different kinds of violence and abuse, and they need to know that it's okay to talk about it. You don't have to be scared. You know, you will be scared, but it's okay to talk about it. There's people that care. There's people that believe you, and that were the advocates at Albion.
Now, how long did you suffer this abuse? Was it a long period of time before you realized you had to get help?
It was only about a year, which I say only, that a year is still long enough. But there is many people who go, I found through group therapy that there was many people going through it for years and years. So as it was starting to get progressively worse is when I kind of was at my point of realizing that I wanted to make a change. That day in January, as I laid there on the floor, beaten pretty badly, it sunk in. I was quiet. I was in freeze mode, but my mind was doing all kinds of things and telling me, this is not okay. You need to get out. You need to make a change.
Was this, I'm curious, this abuse, was mm-hmm. it jealousy? Was it just rage? What was motivating this person?
Honestly, a lot of the abusers, like I was saying, are typically narcissistic. They have troubled pasts, mental illness, sometimes substance abuse. There's many things involved. But he was just not a well person. He, like she said, they kind of prey on you. Very manipulative. Everything is about power and control. And they start off appearing to be what is a nice, normal person. And it's crazy that a year later you can find yourself with a person that you thought you knew. I had known him again as an acquaintance off and on for 20 years. But as I lay there on the floor that day and looked at him and that look in his eyes, I had never seen anybody look at someone with just pure hatred, and it scared me.
Now, Julia, have you seen an increase in cases during COVID-19? People together a lot?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. People who are being harmed at home and within any kind of interpersonal relationship. I mean, there's certainly been a notable increase in what we are aware of as like human trafficking, sexual assault, domestic violence, and an increase in the severity of injuries that are being suffered. And quite a lot of that is connected to people who are being victimized, isolated at home or in quarantine with the person causing them harm. And then to Sarah's point, oftentimes people who are using power and control to do harm against someone else, they're going to do that regardless if they have a substance abuse issue or a mental health issue. Those things do aggravate the situation. And so if you have someone in your life who is very motivated to get power and control over you, but they also have a substance abuse issue or a mental health issue, during the pandemic, that probably really was exasperated quite a bit by maybe them not being able to get medications or the care that they needed or to make it to their own maybe NA or AA group or, you know, something along those lines. And so all kinds of issues, I think, became more prominent and more pronounced during the pandemic, and this is certainly one of them. We've had across the country, not just Albion, we've had a much greater increase, particularly in crisis calls and the level of crisis calls. So much more someone's life in danger calling for help. And that has not only put a stressor on the helping system, but also the advocates and the direct service line, just much like healthcare workers, you know, with those acute crises coming all the time the last 18 months. It's been nonstop for our healthcare workers and emergency departments and hospitals being overrun. And we're seeing that in programs and services like Albion that are doing crisis intervention work. So we're having not only much more calls for service, calls for shelter, certainly then having to keep people isolated within shelter, we haven't been able to house as many families at one time. So we've had to be more creative, you know, in how we use services out in the community, how we house people temporarily out in the community in very quiet and private ways. But then also the acute nature of the calls themselves. People who maybe would have called when they kind of got that first inkling, you know, or early in the abuse, were now forced to wait until their lives are in danger and then making that call. And so we're being very mindful of the impact that it's had on the capacity to serve as far as our organizations, but then also at the direct line worker. You know, what impact is this having on that person who has had trauma coming at them now the past 18 years in a much more prominent manner?
We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center. Before Albion, what was the situation? What was the fate of these victims? What was their situation back then?
Well, goodness, really, what was known as, and I don't like this term, but what was known as the battered women's movement back in the 60s and 70s, that was really the birthing moment for programs like Albion Fellows Bacon Center. And the first emergency shelter here in the United States, I believe, was established back in the late 70s out in Pasadena, California. Now, Albion was established here in 1981, so Evansville wasn't that far along. In the game to get into the shelter, programs to provide to survivors. But back then, there were more animal shelters before then, you know, that were even available to humans, and more laws on the book. And I certainly think that animals should be protected. So that's not me saying doing a comparative. That's just me saying, my goodness, it's taken us a long time to understand that there are humans being hurt by other humans, and there are things that we can do about them. And emergency shelter is not an end-all. And actually, the movement is kind of moving away from emergency shelters as kind of the main program that organizations offer. We're getting more in the field. We're getting more into longer-term, like transitional housing, as a solution to help somebody stabilize before they move on out into permanent housing they can sustain on their own, or bypassing that altogether and working with folks in a mobile way, meeting survivors where they're at, if they even choose to maintain that relationship, because we certainly don't want to tell someone that the only way to safety or well-being is to end the relationship. That could maybe put them even in more danger.
Of course, to get to the root of the problem, prevention.
There's eliminating and there's intervention, and then there's prevention. And so we have a whole prevention program that's designed toward working with folks, working with the community, particularly youth, in educating, training, but giving them options to doing harm against another human being. And so our whole goal would be that harm doing would become rare in our society, in our culture, and that's our goal.
Well, coming up, the important message, of course, from Albion Fellow Bacon Center is that help is just a phone call away. Mm-hmm. We're also going to hear more about the many services available to domestic and sexual assault victims and their families, and what you should do if you suspect someone is being abused. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guests are Julia Catheri, interim director of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center in Evansville. And here with her is Sarah Nurnberger, a survivor who sought and received help from Albion. And she has been very bravely telling her story. Now, we have some troubling statistics to pass along. 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have experienced some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. Does that surprise you, Sarah?
No. Now I would say it doesn't. Back before that abuse happened, I probably might have been a little shocked by that. But I also work in the social work field. So now just hearing those stats, it is alarming, but I believe it because there's just so much going on that we don't even realize. Some people don't believe it's abuse, or it's not reported, or we don't know what's going on, that it could be even different numbers than that, honestly.
The social work field, what do you do?
I am a social worker for a pediatric clinic in town. So.
You're a social worker, and you're involved in this violence, which is part of your training probably as a social worker.
Yep.
to be alert to that.
Yes, we have various trainings actually on domestic violence. We had one recently from Albion. So we are constantly getting those trainings to make sure we're looking for signs of abuse in children and with the families, the moms and dads. So that is a component that we definitely are trained on and look for as well.
And you certainly have a story to underline all of this training.
Yes. Personally, going through that experience helps you to be able to kind of pick up on some of those signs that you see in patients that you meet with. So, yes, that has definitely aided with that process. So,
I think what is surprising and what can be disheartening is that the numbers haven't gotten better in the last 30 years. They've
almost
gotten more prevalent.
Well, the reporting is probably better.
That is true, and so you have to look at it that way. More people hopefully are reporting, but to Sarah's point, there's still probably for every one person reporting, there's probably 10 to 20 who aren't.
Right.
And so we just have to be aware of that, which is why getting the word out for services and for, like, talking about the dynamics of harm is really important so that people can identify it when they see it and can know where to go get help.
There. Yeah. Another shocker, every 92 seconds, another person experiences sexual assault. And sexual violence is a non-legal term that may refer to sexual assault, rape, attempted rape, unwanted sexual touching, and sexual abuse. And often there are secondary survivors impacted by the abuse of a loved one. Let's talk about these secondary survivors, the families who are drawn into this.
Absolutely.
The children.
The children. And I think that's where my mind always goes first, is the children in the home. So the children in the home may not be experiencing firsthand being physically abused or even being the target of emotional abuse, but just by witnessing the violence and the abuse. And when I say violence, I mean the overall dynamics of the abuse and the harm doing. It's not just physical violence at all. And so when you think about that, if you're a child and you're witnessing that, you are also experiencing that. So whether you're the target of the power and control, you're still being impacted by it. And it's so important to be able to provide interventions and support services to children who are witnessing abuse in the home. And then the families. I mean, to Sarah's point, where she went, where she fled to, was her family. And that is common. It's the most common thing in the world for us to go to our family, reach out to those closest to us for help and aid and certainly solace and a place to find harbor. And so that is where we're going to go. And abusers know that. And so that's why safety planning is so important, particularly for people who are leaving, exiting an abusive relationship, even if it's for a night. It can actually escalate the desire and the motivation on the abuser's part to get that power and control back. So they may follow, they may stalk someone. And the first place that they often look is a family's, a close family member, a close friend, a workplace, a church that they know that their victim attends. It's where would I find this person? And that's where they go first. And so that's something to be mindful of. If you know someone in your family, if you know a close friend, a coworker who is experiencing this, or you suspect, it is a good idea for you to understand, like, safety planning. It really is something all of us should understand. And all businesses should be mindful of, churches as well. It's like, what to do if someone that we care about is being harmed or potentially being harmed, to be as safe ourselves in this situation.
Now, Sarah, there were no children witnessed the abuse against you?
No. I do have a 10-year-old daughter, but she was not present for the abuse.
But how has this affected her and your other family members?
My family, as Julia said, the abuser does a very good job of trying to cut ties from your family. So during the year I dated him, he made it very difficult for me not only to be close with people in my family that I am very close with, as in my mother and sisters, but he made it very difficult and would even taunt and ridicule me with my own child. I kind of came to a point as a mother that I had to do what I had to do to make sure she wasn't present and keep her safe, and that was one of the hardest parts of my journey was, our first job as mothers is to keep our kids safe. So that was difficult, but he would make sure he would do everything possible to make sure I wasn't spending time with my kid. And then when I would come back, he would say, I don't even think you want your kid. He would say really awful things to basically make me feel like I was not a good mother and didn't want my kid around, when in all actuality, I was keeping my kid safe from what she was going to witness if he was present doing those things with her around.
Wow. So how do you start that conversation, Julia, with a loved one who may be an abuse victim?
I think the most important thing that somebody can do when they're reaching out to someone they care about who may be victimized by this type of harm is starting with, I'm concerned. I see you. These are the things I'm noticing. I believe you. It's so important to take the stigma out and the judgment out of any kind of conversation. The truth of the matter is, I think a lot of us would want to say to ourselves, oh, if I was in that situation, this is what I would do. But the truth of the matter is, unless you are in that particular situation, even if you've been victimized before, unless you know and you're experiencing firsthand all of the circumstances involved in this particular individual situation, you don't know what you'll do because you're not in that particular situation. So removing the stigma, removing the judgment is so important. None of us should feel stigmatized. Sarah should not feel stigmatized because this happened to her. Even being a social worker and being well-trained, she should not feel any stigma or judgment from us in that, because this can happen to any of us.
It really can.
It really can. And so it's really important to treat this other human being like the human being they are. Meet them exactly where they are. Believe them. They don't have to prove anything to us, you know? If there's an investigation that needs to happen because criminal acts have occurred, then let's let law enforcement do that. Let's stay in our lane, right? And individuals, when you're approaching a family member, a friend, a coworker, remember that. Trying to investigate and prove this is not your job. Your job is to be there offering support, offering a connection to a place like Albion, to a place like Holly's House, Lampion, the Y, you know, some place where somebody who's being victimized can reach out for services, for that third objective party to, you know, talk to. Chances are, if you have a friend or a family member who's going through this, you're not going to hear all the details. They're going to want to protect you from having to hear the trauma that they're experiencing. Yes. They also are probably going to minimize it because they do care and love for this other person. And then, like Sarah said, they're kind of in denial a bit, you know, because, you know, after he treats me this way, he says he's sorry, or she makes amends and she promises she'll never do it again, you know. And I want to believe them because I love them and care for them, or I have children with them. You know, it'll get better for a period of time and then it'll cycle back up again. So the best thing we can do is believe and support with no judgment.
So Sarah, you've been there and you've done that.
Yes.
What is your advice to someone out there who's maybe on, I don't know what to do next?
I would say the safety planning is crucial. I actually didn't have a plan because by the time I was realizing it was unfolding. But for people who have been in it for a while, that safety planning of how are you going to get out safely, and then when you're ready, I think the biggest thing is your friends or family or the advocates at Albion, anybody you reach out to, is just that understanding and that belief that Julia was talking about is crucial. Those people saying, we believe you, and just being at arm's length or a phone call away. It takes 7 to 10 times for a victim or survivor to leave a relationship. So a lot of times those people in your family have seen you almost leave that person. And the time that they come to you, help them go to their aid, like my sister that day. Just listen to them and believe them.
The Albion Fellows Bacon Center has been providing safe haven and support for victims of domestic and sexual violence for 40 years. So, Julia, looking ahead, what are the future projects or plans at Albion?
Well, we need the community now more than ever because, to your point, the pandemic has had a real a real increased demand on our services. And we have, while we've expanded our facility to house and serve more people here in the Evansville and surrounding area, that means we need more financial resources. We need more donated resources to do those services. We did have a gala that was supposed to take place in October, and we've postponed it to April in light of just being mindful of, you know, inside gatherings, but because that's our largest fundraiser for the year. Mm-hmm. And so we're a little concerned about ending out the year. We were going to go out with, you know, hopefully a big, you know, ta-da with our 40th anniversary celebration, and we're pushing that to April. But we definitely need the support of the community. And as we evolve our programs and services to be even more trauma-informed and even more survivor-centered, we'll have lots more volunteer opportunities and lots more opportunities to donate items and all kinds of things.
I think it's also important to note this is not just an Evansville-based operation.
Not,
you reach out to a lot of counties.
We really do. Really, the 11 counties across southern Indiana, we're going into, you know, the schools and doing our prevention programs with the youth in those communities. We also have advocates that go into those communities, and we partner really, really strongly. So there's Crisis Connection in Jasper that we're good partners with, and we kind of, you know, we, Du Bois County is one of the counties we serve, but they're located in Jasper, so we want to be, you know, we try not to duplicate services. So Albion and the Y are really the emergency shelter programs here in southern Indiana. There's other types of non-residential services, and that's why that collaboration and partnership is so important.
If someone listening to this program needs help, what do they do?
They would, they could call us, they could email us, they could Facebook message us. They can, we're there 24 hours a day. But really 24 hours a day, we can be responsive, whether it's on by the phone or text or email or however, in person even, if that's necessary.
And Sarah, I'll give you the final word here. How important is Albion Fellows Bacon Center to this community?
They are a crucial part to Evansville here and the surrounding counties. It is an organization that literally it saved my life, and they help so many people. And I just want to say thank you to your organization for what they do, because that process, I may not even be sitting here today if it wasn't for that organization.
My guests have been Julie Catheri, Interim Executive Director of the Albion Fellows Bacon Center, and Sarah Nurnberger, a survivor who has bravely shared her story with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management.